Today on the show, acclaimed singer-songwriter Colin Hay is on the podcast. We talk his days in his band Minute Work, having a career boost from Zach Braff, and much more on episode 69 of Who Writes This Stuff? Hello and welcome to Who Writes This Stuff, direct from my house in Nashville, Tennessee. I am your host, Nick Flora. Thank you for listening. You once again have made an excellent decision in what you're going to listen to for the next hour or so. This is a really exciting episode for a few reasons. More on that in a minute. But at first, it's the part of the show we always start off where I share with you what I learned this week.
What I learned this week.
What you learned.
As many of you know, this week, we lost one of the greats, Mr. Spock himself, Leonard Nimoy. And as often happens when somebody of note passes away, a bunch of trivia about their life and career sort of surfaces, or maybe things we've sort of forgot about them. We knew, but maybe forgot. And the big sort of, moment for me this week was learning that Leonard Nimoy directed the 1987 comedy Three Men and a Baby, starring Ted Danson, Tom Selleck, and America's sweetheart, Steve Guttenberg. Remember Steve Guttenberg? I swear, there was a good decade where Steve Guttenberg could do no wrong. Maybe 5 years. Man, that's a guy I'd love to have on the show. But yeah, Spock directed it. Leonard Nimoy himself directed that movie. Hilarious and crazy to me. And also, great job. I mean, when that movie's on cable, everybody stops and watches it. It's delightful. And that's what I learned this week.
What I learned this week.
What you learned.
If you would like to share with me and the listeners of the show what you learned this week, you can email whowritesthisstuffpodcast@gmail.com and let me know, and I'll even read it on the show. Or you can tweet at whowritespod on Twitter, of course, and or post it on our wall at facebook.com/whowritesthisstuff. And those are both easily accessible, and I read all of it. So for those interested, I wanted to let you know we now have a Spotify playlist of selections from all the guests who've been on the show. To find it, you can just go to Spotify and search Who Writes This Stuff under the playlist section. And I'll update it weekly from everybody who's been on the show, all 70 episodes at this point. I'll try to update that as often as possible. So just crank it on when you're at work. And it's like we at the podcast are there with you. So today's episode is, like I said earlier, with the acclaimed singer-songwriter who you might be familiar with, Colin Hay. He's a founding member of the platinum-selling band Minute Work, or you might know him from his many solo albums, including his contributions to the Garden State soundtrack or his appearances on the NBC show Scrubs. He has a new record out called New Year People, which is really great, and he was nice enough to come on the podcast when he was passing through on his tour last month, and I went to the venue and talked to him, so there's a little bit of like background noise that you can hear, and I talked to him backstage, and even though this is a shorter episode than normal due to Colin needing to go on stage and perform his show, it's still packed with great stories and insight to a truly unique artist, a really cool guy. He was warm and quirky and funny, and it was a pleasure to chat with him. So let's get to it. Here's episode 69 with Colin Hay. Thanks for taking the time to do this. I know you are a busy man. Do you come to Nashville often?
No.
You're checking out the mic.
It's a nice, where'd you get that? It looks like a very nice microphone. Is it nice?
It looks nice. I think it is. It's, you know, Blue makes it. They're a pretty reliable company.
Yes.
And I think it's their sort of condensed version. I mean, it goes directly USB into the computer. I think it's the...
Is it specifically made for things such as podcasts?
I think so. That sort of thing, any kind of traveling demos, that kind of thing. Pretty good quality. I'm a musician too, so I've done some demos on it. I think I could probably release this, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. So it's not bad. How long have you been coming to Nashville?
How long have I been coming to Nashville? 33 years.
Really?
It's the first time I came to Nashville.
Really?
33 years ago.
Is it it's considered, other than LA and New York, sort of one of the only other industry towns in the country, I guess, but do you enjoy it here? Do you find the similarities between those other places here, or
Well, I try and avoid whenever I can the music industry.
Oh, yes. That's actually pretty smart. You figured it out. The clue, the key is to sort of avoid it and let it come to you. I don't know. You had a lot of success early on. And then nothing. Is that what you would call it?
You're pretty
nothing?
Much. Yeah, nothing. I was nothing. Just my years in the wilderness.
Is that how you view it?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I was lucky in the sense. I mean, I never was poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or hungry.
Right.
So I was lucky in that sense. But when the old band went away, then when I started playing, I think. It wasn't really even so much when the old band stopped. It was really a course of over. I did a number of records which really were commercial failures.
Mm-hmm.
After Men at Work, I did the third Men at Work album was really not successful.
Okay.
First two were successful. The third one was not. I mean, it depends on how you measure success as well. I mean, I liked the third record. You know, I thought there were some cool things on it, but it didn't. Mm-hmm. No one bought it.
Mm-hmm.
So, in those terms, it wasn't. Is it
sort of a fool's errand to try to figure out why some records work with audiences and some don't? Or do you just have to sort of stop trying to guess and put out whatever's honest to you as an artist?
Well, I don't know what it's like for other people. Maybe some people are good at that, you know, and can figure that out and be successful.
Right.
But I haven't really figured that out. And it's an interesting subject. But probably would take a little while to really talk about in depth. But
but
I think the feeling that I always had was that, I mean, I started playing music when I was about 14 or 15, and then it took about 15 years to kind of, in a way, for it to feel like the planets were lined up again.
I see.
Oh no, the planets were lined up. Where it didn't really kind of matter, you know, things were conspiring to create some kind of success, you know, and you were part of that. You'd spearheaded it, and a lot of things conspired to aid that, in a sense, you know, like, you know, you start playing music, and then I found somebody that I wanted to work with, and said, okay, I want to work with you, and then we started to write songs. The other guitar player in the old band, Ron, he was exceptional guitar player and very, very inspired person to work with. So that was cool. And then
you would just play off his energy and
and vice versa, you know. And then I went to university, met the drummer there, met the guy, became my manager, and so all these kind of people who I recognized as being important in this quest,
right,
you know, for some kind of musical world domination, which I was obsessed with, you know.
Right, really.
Yeah, and it worked, you know. And the only label that was interested in us happened to be CBS Records, which became Sony, and they were the biggest label in the world. They were the only ones that really offered us a deal, which was fortunate because they were really the only ones that we were interested in.
Yeah,
and it was a horrible, horrible deal. I mean, almost a criminal deal, you know. And you know, most young bands can, you know, start off with getting maybe 13 or 14%, you know, of royalty. And I think ours was like 4 or 3 or 4, you know. And you kind of, it sounds like it's a big complaint because we were very successful, but we were successful. But
right.
But that notwithstanding, it was still a horrible, horrible record deal.
Right.
And then getting back to your original question, which I've completely forgotten what it was.
Gauging success.
Yeah. Yeah. So we became monumentally successful, you know, in the way only a few people managed to do to have. And then we just broke up, you know, which was, you could argue, was ridiculous and silly and may have been, but it's really, you don't really know what would have happened if we had stayed together.
True.
We might have broken up sooner if we hadn't become successful. You don't really know. But anyway, the third Men at Work album was not, that was only three of us. Really, the Men at Work was really five people, you know, the five original band. That was really what the band was.
Do you still find the people, like fans of yours, love that third album and bring it up to you, even though it was sort of seen as a commercial failure?
Not really.
No.
Not really, no.
I was one of those, because sometimes you will put out something And it just sort of goes, but it just sort of needs time. Or maybe sometimes a song or an album is ahead of its time.
Yeah, I mean, I still think it's a good record, but no, there's not really that many people that, that really bring it up and go, ah, you know. I mean, a few people, but not that many.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I had, that's right, that's what I was talking about. Then I had a few records after that that didn't really do anything. One, the Looking for Jack, it was called, and then a record called Wayfaring Sons on MCA, and then I got dropped. So it was kind of like this kind of decline, and then it just was, and then I was all just me or nothing. Traveling in a fried out combi on a hippie trail head full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. She said, do you come from a land down under? Women glow and men plunder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
At what point in time, where were you as far as your headspace and maybe your career as well when the, I guess it was however long ago, 10 years ago, 11 years ago at this point, where the Garden State soundtrack hit, or the sort of Zach Braff era where I feel like he couldn't stop talking about you for a while in your music. And you definitely had to have seen some sort of a surge in that.
Yeah, that was about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working and touring for 15 years before that.
Yeah.
Which is a long time.
Yeah.
Before I became involved with Compass, which was good, who are based here, the record label, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a good moment where they started to put out my records, because before that I was just on my own and it was doing it very inefficiently.
So you were just an independent artist for a while, essentially. Just,
well, I still am.
You. Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean I you know, I work with them, but we have a partnership where I own my master's.
So you have figured it out. I feel like I have a lot of friends in town who you know, signed in the 80s and 90s to something, and there when I was sort of brought up in the school of trying to, like, that's what the goal is, and then I get here and meet them in the middle and they're like, no, run the other way, you know. It's sort of like, you know,
well, I don't think there really is a right way or a wrong way. I mean, if a big label came along and we're interested in signing you, you know, you'd be crazy not to look at it.
Sure.
Because sometimes it makes sense,
mm-hmm.
you know. But the reality is that nobody was coming near me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wasn't certainly going near any labels to... I mean, I think actually I did. I think I actually, at one point, solicited all the major labels to try and get a deal, but I don't think I even heard back from any of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is going back to early 2000s.
And this might be a stupid question, but... Do you really, I mean, I know, like I said, there's a lot of people who got into your music through the Garden State, the sort of Zach Braff era of him pushing out there, being on Scrubs, that kind of thing. And then I'm sure you have a lot of fans who know you through Men at Work, and then the other sort of group that has followed you throughout. Do you care how people get into your music? That might be a tough question. Or is there sort of like, well, you're a young punk who, you don't even know my catalog that well. Is there ever that kind of mentality?
No, I love the youngsters. Youngsters. Yeah, no, I really love it. I love it if young people discover your music. It's fantastic. It makes you feel young.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, when the Scrubs thing started, and then there were people before that who were younger. I mean, the thing was with Men at Work is that I really started with, when Men at Work was over and I started doing the solo thing, it wasn't really that I had a lot of you know, Men at Work fans that would come and see me. There were some. But mainly it was people who were younger who hadn't seen the band but had heard of the band, and they were too young to come and see the band.
Mm.
And they'd heard the music maybe through their parents even, and
right.
they came along. And then as the Scrubs thing happened, then the audience became younger still.
Mm-hmm.
But it reminded me, and the reasons why they would come to see me play were... the same, they looked like the same kind of people that were coming to see me in the 70s.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they looked the same as well.
They were kind of recycled versions.
They were kind of like a little bit hippie-ish, kind of like,
right?
You know. I mean, not a lot of tie-dye, but, you know. But
the fashion changes, but, you know, they're still the same.
Yeah, they were kind of young folk, and And I mean, I said this a couple of times, but you know, I was in a coffee shop in Springfield, Illinois, and there was a guy. There were two guys selling coffee. One was about 40, and one was about 20. And the young guy looked at me and said, "I love your music, man." I said, "Oh, thanks." He said, "Overkill, that's my favorite song." I said, "Thanks." And the older guy looked at him and he goes, "You know who that is?" And he goes, "Yeah, he's in Scrubs." And the older guy goes, "Scrubs? What is Scrubs? He was in Men at Work." And the young guy goes, "What's Men at Work?"
I can get to sleep. I think about the implications of diving in too deep, and possibly the complications, especially at night. I worry over situations I know will be all right. Perhaps it's just imagination. Day after day it reappears. Night after night my heartbeat shows the fear. Ghosts appear and fade away.
You have this new album coming out next week, I think. How I'm in the process myself, as this is a little bit of a selfish question, of writing a new album and approaching, you know, how I'm going to write. And this is only my fourth, but this is your 12th, I think. Maybe that's not right. I might have my information wrong.
I think it may be an either an odd or an even dozen. No question.
Well, I'll take we'll just take a stab and throw a dart at. It's 12. One of those numbers. Yeah,
it's a good word. It's a good.
It's good. It feels 12. It feels solid. What? How do you approach writing at this point? Is there new inspiration that you draw from, or is it sort of you go back to the well of how you've always kind of done it? But when you're approaching a batch of songs, you kind of be like, I don't know where this batch is going to come from, or do you sort of have it figured out?
No, I don't really look at them in terms of batches. I just look at a kind of a song at a time in a way.
Okay. Are you always writing throughout, or do you sort of, oh, it's time to make a record, I better crank out a few songs?
Well, it's different all the time, but I tend to just play little ideas into the iPhone.
Mm.
And then I have little musical ideas and lyrical ideas, and then I have a lot of them over a period of time. And then when I have time, when I go back home, I listen to them and I just see if anything strikes me as being worth persevering with. And then I try and finish them. And with this record, I had a lot of co-writes with a friend of mine who lives up the road from me, a guy called Michael Georgiadis, who's been around. He's a little bit older than me, but he's been around for, you know, he was in a band called Hamilton Streetcar. In the 60s, we opened up for the Doors, and
oh wow,
you know, and he made a record with Bernie Ledden, and called, I think it's called Natural Progressions. Anyway, he's a great songwriter, and so I had a bunch of songs that I was going to work on this record, which I ended up doing. There was a few of them, like a song called "If I'd Been a Better Man," and there's a few, and I had this idea for this song called "Next Year People" that I liked. But he came along and he had a bunch of musical ideas, and then he just hit this kind of vein of what I think is kind of musical brilliance, and would come around to my place and say, "I got this thing." And he'd play a musical idea, and I'd go, "Oh, that's really good." And then we would just record a rough version of it, you know, just. And then I got another one. Oh, you got another one. Okay, you got another one. So I ended up doing six of his.
Oh, wow.
Six co-writes with him, you know, and he would often have the musical idea, and then I would come up with lyrics. So that's, and so there's about six of our songs on this record.
You work.
So
better.
I had help.
You work better like that, collaborating, or do you find...
No, I think. Well, no, it depends who I'm collaborating with, you know. I mean, I like working with people that bring something solid to the table, because often I work with people and I go, okay, well, here's an idea, and then they... Well, it's not often that I do, but, I mean, I've worked in the past where you have an idea and then somebody goes, oh, I would like to work with you, and you do that, and then they just come in and basically, you know, do fuck all, really.
Right, yeah. Oh, we've all had that experience. You're like, well, that was a wasted afternoon, but okay.
So it's nice when you get people that actually pull their weight.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can.
Otherwise, I'll just do it myself.
I know. I've had those co-writes too where I'm like, this would have been much more productive if I could have just done it myself, because you basically, it's like dragging dead weight. But then sometimes you have moments of brilliance. Mm. That's true. You have an ability in your songwriting that I greatly admire, where you can, there's sadness in it, but there's always the sort of tinges of hope. I don't know if you know that you do that, but you do it really well. And I've listened to music for a long time, and it's always seems to be a recurring thing. Is this something, do you think of yourself as having that sort of quality, or are you aware of this? Where you
well,
kind of
not really.
Play
I mean,
with both
people,
ends?
People bring that up.
Okay.
Because
you can listen to it when you're melancholy, but then there, it makes you feel better. It does something where it makes you feel better. Like, it's going to be all right. Like, you know, this heartbreak is happening. Let's address it. But,
well, I think that there is deep, dark sadness in the world, you know, and in the world mm-hmm. as a whole. And in everyone, there is potential for great despair.
Sure.
And sadness. I mean, mainly because we fucking die.
Yeah, that's the end.
You know, and it's like, okay, what do you do from this point till then that's going to make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, and therein lies the optimism of making the best of what you have.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's a lot of, I mean, I think there's a lot of insanity in the world, you know. I mean, maybe there always has been, but it seems like the world is run by just mad people.
Yeah,
you know,
it manifests itself in the strangest ways, but it's always consistent.
So I like going around the place and playing tunes and talking to people and playing for people, and the people that come and see me tend to, you know, they tend to connect on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me feel good.
I drink good coffee every morning. Comes from a place that's far away. When I'm done, I feel like without you here, there is less to say. I don't want you thinking I'm unhappy. What is closer? If I lived till I was 102, I just don't think I'll ever get over you.
Is your driving motivation now to continue? Because I know there's multiple times for me anyway, and I've only been doing this for 10 years, where I'm sort of like, well, what's the point? I'm just going to put out more songs, and you know, you over analyze it and what your motivation
is. I don't really think there's a point, really.
Really?
Nah, I don't really think there is.
As long as you keep enjoying it, you'll keep doing it.
I don't even think you necessarily have to enjoy it.
Really?
No, it's a job.
Yeah, it is a job. Yeah.
It's a job. It's your responsibility.
Does it feel like a job?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you're honest about that.
Yeah, it feels like a fucking job, all right, yeah.
What part feels like a job the most? Is it travel or the whole, is it the whole thing?
Oh, I like having a job.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of hours in the day after breakfast, so it's like I like to have a job.
Right.
And the job that I've chosen to do is play music and write songs, and so it's like being, you know, I'm self-employed.
Yeah.
You know, but the people that have come to see me over the years and the people that get your records, I do feel a sense of, I wouldn't say that a sense of responsibility, but it's almost like a kind of a, it's like a weird kind of conspiracy that you have, because they've kept me feeling good about what I do all these years because they've come to see me. I mean, sometimes it was 15, 20 people, you know, and you think, well, you know, maybe I should do something else, you know.
Right.
You know, and then someone will say to you after the show, please don't do anything. Please don't stop, you know. And
right.
So it just gives you some encouragement.
Sure. When you're writing, do you think about those people?
No.
You think like, what do you think about? Just making
the song good. Yeah, making the song good. Yeah, as good making the song as good as it can be.
Yeah. So would you consider yourself a craftsman in that way, where you're like, well, we have to like shave this song down to make it work in all the ways that we want it to work, or is that way too overthinking?
Well, I think that there is some kind of arc where when you first start off, you try and put a lot of stuff on the song, and then you get to a certain point and you start taking stuff off it.
Yeah.
You know, taking things away that you don't need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done a few albums. I mean, there's still acoustic is the prevalent instrument, but you've done a few albums that have just kind of stripped the production off, and it was just you and a guitar. And I'm sure you toured that way as well.
Yeah, most of the time.
Is that just a lesson you learn in time? Like,
it's all circumstance, you know. I never really planned to go out on solo, but that was all that was on offer. You know, people would want me to play and come and play in their town, for example, but they weren't going to pay any money, so I couldn't have a band anyway.
Right.
So I just went on my own, and then people went, "Oh, I like that." And then next time I go, they go, "Oh, we only want you. Don't bring anybody."
Do you find that when you tour, it's better to have people around you for sane purposes, or do you like sort of being a lone wolf?
No, I don't really like people around that much.
Not really?
No, people I like sometimes, but no, I tend
you,
to...
Do you like people in general?
Yeah, I like people. Hmm. You know, I like them well enough, you know. Depends.
Right.
They can be very annoying.
Yes, that's true. When you talk to the 1,000 hotel desk clerk, it's just sort of, yeah.
They're okay. I mean,
they're
people
fine.
Have got a job to do. Yeah.
That is true. I do find the older I get, the more annoyed I get at people who are paid to be nice to me, though. I have to sort of back up a little bit, like the desk clerk or the person at the grocery store or the person when, as soon as you walk into a store and they just beeline it for you. There's a little bit of a, I know you're doing your job, but I'm fine. I've shopped for shirts before, you know. I don't know. That's when I start getting, it's the mall kiosk person who's like, excuse me, sir, do you have a minute? Where I sort of get bugged by people. But I just wonder, because you've been doing this
I usually
much
step
longer.
Out of the store and just look at them and go, catch me, and then I run off. And they go, look at me in a bewildered fashion.
You can't live without hope that things will change for the better. You can't live without the dream of someone reading your letter. We've had dust storms before and spit out the dirt. We've had droughts before, but none quite like this. We've had winds that cut up your face all to pieces, black blizzards that stripped all the paint off your car. Fires like twisters, no sisters of mercy. They come with no warning, only that sound. God is roaring drunk and out on the town. Next year everything will come good. The rains, they will fall and we'll dance on the hood. We'll fill up our bellies with plentiful food. We'll eat, drink and be merry. Yeah, next year people wait and see. We're next year people, you and me.
Do you? We always wrap up the podcast by having the artist tell, and by we I mean me, Royal We, an embarrassing or bad show story that can make us all feel better. There's a lot of musicians that listen to this show. Do you have anything that sticks out when somebody's like, what's the worst gig you ever played? Whether it's the venue's fault or the something that happened where you were like, well, that was awful, I wouldn't do that again. Is there anything that comes to mind?
I think there was one gig that I played, which has ended up being quite... interesting because of the fact that I still remember it and it was funny. But I mean, I played this show in Hawaii, in Honolulu. It was called, the place was called the Gold Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a disco place. It was a biker bar, but they had a kind of a, what they called a disco, I suppose, and they had a dance floor, and those lights that kind of just keep going round and round, going nowhere, you know, right. The loneliest lights in the world, you know, it's like lights with nowhere to go, you know, it's just like, fuck, we have to go around this fucking circle again, you know.
Yeah,
you know.
I know exactly.
And then
about.
I was in the middle of that, and there wasn't a stage. I had to just play these, you know, play for the bikers who were leaning against the bar, drinking and had no interest in me whatsoever. And so I was playing to the cracks of their asses because they were standing there, and they weren't even looking at me. So that was interesting. And it wasn't interesting.
Oh, no.
It was interesting in the sense that it wasn't interesting at all.
Right.
And. But before I came on, they played my album, you know, Men at Work album, you know, because the guy thought that'd be a good idea.
Yeah, that's always
good.
So
then I
idea.
Just came on and played the songs.
You know the songs you heard? Here they are.
Here they are again, but without those other guys.
Yeah. Here's alternate versions of these. Oh, that's excruciating. But, you know, we lived through it. We lived through those moments. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know you're a busy man, and I appreciate it.
Oh, very, very busy. Very
so busy.
Well, that's it for this episode. Colin Hay's Next Year People is available now on iTunes, Amazon, or wherever records are sold. And make sure to check his tour dates at colinhay.com. Well, thanks for listening. For episode 69 and Who Writes This Stuff, I'm Nick Flora. Now go do something creative.